I'm delighted to be here this afternoon. Thanks to Ellis Sandoz reading my Christmas letter off season and suddenly remembering that we had an affiliation going back to Louisiana State University days. One of the things about the email world, however, is that as you are reading traffic back and forth over various arrangements about this, sometimes there's lots of baggage and attachments that remain to various communications that you receive. And there were several communications back and forth to Ellis as he was saying something to me in which somebody was responding about some aspect of the panel. And then at the very end, there was this one question, and who the hell is Tim Lamparis? So I find this my last attempt at an academic meeting, that question came to mind as well, where I went to the International Studies Association meeting on a Sunday morning panel, and if you've ever given a talk to nobody, I can honestly claim that we had a panel in which there was absolutely nobody present. So I am grateful for this high turnout of the Philadelphia Society. In 1807, Napoleon opined, "As for China, let her sleep, for when she awakens, she will rule the world." Napoleon himself vanished from the scene in eight short years after that remark, and the 19th century became Britain's century, the Pax Americana, in which the sun never set on the British Empire. After two spasms of convulsive war in the 20th century, this century became known as the American century, our century. And I'm here, as others have already before me, come to assert that in many ways today, in one way or another, China has arisen. Although I will say, I think fortunately, it is a little confused at the moment, but it has nevertheless arisen. Whether or not she will rule the world, this new millennium opens up with an Asia destined to be the central arena of international politics. And that's what I want to focus my remarks on today, the centrality of the Asian arena to the course of the next century, and the three images that ambiguously contend for, in a way, the dominant metaphor with which we view this this Asian century, that is one of cooperation, one of competition, or one of conflict. I think as an anchor, as a foundation to this discussion at the beginning, there are statistics that lay out this new centrality, and they are everywhere. And I don't want you to drown in them, but it's important for us to recall the fundamental ways and what shall we say, the mathematics of international relations have decisively changed. And I would say that the hinge, the pivot moment when the door opened up to what we have arrived at today, occurred in 1985, 1986. It was a time then in 85 and 86 when there were three discrete entities to the study of international relations. There was a first world, there was a second world, and there was a third world. And everyone made a point of analyzing these three. It was a time when the United States and the free world commanded about, the United States its alone commanded about 25% of the world's gross world product, if you will. Our European allies, another 25%. Between us then, we held claim to 50% of the world's resources. And the socialist commonwealth, as they like to call themselves, of the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, and China, perhaps another 20%. With the rest of the world having distributed elsewhere. 85 and 86, however, two things happened that opened up a different reality. Number one, the U.S. changed from being the world's largest creditor nation in two short years to being the world's largest debtor nations. And with that came a whole host of literature talking about declinism, endism, imperial overstretch, which sort of missed the fact that our competitors were disappearing even more rapidly than we were. Literally to a posture today where the Soviet Union's, or now Russia's, economy now ranks behind Mexico's, that this one proud commonwealth sequestering 20% of the world's wealth, in Russia in particular, is down to 2% of the world's wealth. Well, the big question is that where did this all change to? For a while, when you looked at sort of 1960, the start of the development decade, Asia and Japan, or East Asia and Japan, had only a 4% stake of world's wealth. And this rose in 1973 to 15%, largely under the rise of the Japanese miracle, an Asia that was being fueled by the Japanese engine to the point where the same mid-80s period, we didn't worry about China. The big phrase was Japan Inc. And by 23 or 2008, Japan would pass us up, and we tried to imagine a world of competition with Japan. By 1998, Asia's as a whole's stake in the world economy had risen to 26% of gross world product in one way of calculating it, so that today we have sort of three central blocks of economic concentration, about 25% still in the United States, about 25% amongst our European allies, and now Asia at 26%. This tremendous shift of global resources to Asia has obviously fundamentally reconfigured our conception of international relations as a whole. And it's interesting to see the ways in which this has shifted. At the start of the development decade, we had sort of three worlds of Latin America, Africa, and Asia, with Africa, this was in 1995, dollars having about 500 per capita GNP, Asia 1,000 per capita, and Latin America 2,000. Latin America was seen as the focus of the Alliance for Progress, that we would move Latin America first into the developed world. Asia and Latin America would follow. Well, over this period from 1960 to 1998, some dramatic things happened. Latin America's per capita GNP did rise from 2,000 to 4,000. It doubled. Africa's remained static all the way through this period to the central to the present day. But Asia's per capita GNP from 1960 to 1998 went from 1,000 to 8,000. So that the positions between Latin America and Asia have completely flip-flopped. In fact, Asia is now, as a region, no longer really in a sort of ambiguous middle here, where its economy is about equal to that of Central Europe. And with this have come some powerful shifts in at least economic power concentrations to the international system, so that the Asian mix, the new industrializing countries, now have economies equivalent to those of the vigorous, smaller European countries. South Korea and Holland have virtually identical GDPs now. We have an international system where Japan has the second largest economy. China, by some measures, purchase power in parity, is the third, or if it's not the third, it's at least equivalent behind Germany's and equal to Britain and Italy's. And India has the fifth largest economy. Asia has arrived, right, as a central place. And with this, the balance of our own economic teeter-totter has shifted from an Atlantic connection to a Pacific connection. We do 20% of our trade across the Atlantic waters and one-third or 33% across Pacific waters with a 40% in our same hemisphere. And these trends continue. That is, if you look at the decade of the 90s alone, and then I'll leave these statistics behind us here, half of the world's increase of wealth in the decade of the 90s took place in Asia. And with this period, mentioned earlier, was made of hegemonic stability theory, that as we look at that the Cold War, for all of its strategic standoff and perils, was also a remarkable expansion of world wealth. This, of course, guaranteed by American hegemonic stability, so that nations within their own economies grew by about 2% during the Cold War. World trade grew from 8 to 10% during the same period. In the decade of the 90s, trade in Asia expanded by between 16 to 20%, double the world average. So the world is moving to Asia, as is the weight of the American economy. So that as we are forced to look at our own destiny, increasingly at this new arena of focus to international relations. We are caught in the ambiguities of thinking, of using language, of devising strategies around these three metaphors of cooperation, competition, and conflict. And I will argue that there are plenty of reasons to live in each one of these three realities simultaneously, but it's very important right now in terms of which of these metaphors captures our attention the greatest, because we are at a point where we are going to determine the course of this future by the way in which we think about it. I will also argue that it is equally important that other societies are having to make these same sorts of decisions. And Hainan Island, of course, puts a concentration on that. Hainan Island, of course, I think was handled in diplomatic terms with a great deal of finesse by the administration that allowed for both sides to back off without, so that an incident stayed just at that. It was not a crisis, it was merely an incident, and yet the incident stirred up portents. In a way, I would argue that were it not for Hainan Island, I would have assumed that this conference would have been a little bit more diffuse about thinking about Asia. But I think everybody's mind started conjuring up images of conflict. And that, of course, may be the lasting damage to Hainan Island, as it opened, that it has reified the metaphor of conflict between us and Asia, and China in particular. We need, of course, I think in the shadow of this event, to remind ourselves that there is a lot of areas in which, as we move into Asia, we have cooperative relationships with many parts of the region. We have formal alliances, of course, with Japan, with whom we do joint maneuvers, with whom we have a joint defense strategy, with South Korea, certainly more informally with Taiwan, and we're redeveloping ties to the Philippines, and with the ASEAN countries and Southeast Asia, the Asian Regional Forum commits us to consultations on defense issues every year. And with trade, with China, we're working out membership with a World Trade Organization with the Chinese. We're talking about the Olympic Games. Certainly, we are trying to unravel the effects of Clinton's acknowledgement of a one-China policy. We would probably not be in nearly the mess without that kind of language. But there are people who look for a kind of one world, in Wendell Willkie's terms, in Asia and in China. So there is a strand that attempts to see this and project this into this century. Our new president has come in with a new metaphor, has raised the term strategic competitor, that China is our competitor. And there's lots of ways in which this is, as well, and maybe even more so, an accurate metaphor for our dealings with Asia. Certainly in economic terms, there is lots more competition to our relationship, perhaps, than cooperation. That is, our balance of trade is unfavorable, not just with Japan, but it's unfavorable with China, than it is with Korea as well. It is only really in our own hemisphere where we have more favorable trade balances. So there are all these difficult issues of barriers to trade, the complexities of the Japanese economy, their distribution system, the ways in which it's difficult to do business there. There's Chinese practices, the lack of transparencies of their banking system, their use of slave labor, what we call dumping practices of that occur in both Korea, South Korea, and China. So there are ways in which we have become competitive, and we need almost arbitration from bodies like the World Bank to sort out a competitive relationship. Recently, and certainly in this conference as a whole, there have been lots of tales of conflict here. One of the things at the end of the Cold War, Georgi Arbatov of the North American Institute said at the end of the Cold War, we are going to do something terrible to you. We are going to deprive you of an enemy. The ethos of an enemy has certainly resurrected itself loud and clear in these last few days here. A kind of nascent Cold War thinking is almost coming back as almost a desideratum. We're so used to thinking in terms of an adversary. It concentrates the minds, it justifies policies, and one could shut your eyes and think of the language of the Soviet Union being replaced by China. It's important to remember that we have fought four wars in Asia in the last century. We have fought as many wars in Asia as we have in our own continent. We sort of began our debutante ball to great powerdom. It was in the Philippine Islands and the 20,000 people we lost in suppressing the Philippine insurrection. We fought again in the Pacific War, where we lost more soldiers in Asia than we did in the European theater. And of course, we fought the Korean and Vietnam War, in which one has to note that in the Korean case, the Chinese were direct adversaries of ours. 1 million Chinese were killed in that war. And recent scholarship has pointed out just the ways in which we grossly underestimated the degree of Chinese involvement in the Vietnam War itself. This has left powerful strategic legacies and memories in the United States. We have always seen ourselves, in Alfred Thayer Mahan's terms, as a maritime power, radiating power out from our two seas, from Atlantic to Pacific. That has its modern sort of echo of this in the two MRCs, two major regional contingency strategies through the 3rd Fleet and the 7th Fleet in the Pacific, and the 2nd Fleet, the 6th Fleet, and the 5th Fleet in the Atlantic. We have 330,000 soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines in the Pacific, 190 capital ships, 6 carrier battle groups, and 1,500 modern combat aircraft. We rule the seas in Asia, and it is ours for at least the immediate future. The question is, for how long, as questions have been raised. Clearly, as we look at Taiwan, we have a situation that's heating up. And a political system that's democratic facing a communist one. But now, I'm an academic, and usually we lead with theory. With this more policy-minded group, I wanted to close with theory. That is, how do we navigate between these three different metaphors? And that is where somehow we need to finally resort, when all else fails, to academic theories. That is, what is it that should guide us in these three competing realities that create the ambiguity that has just been noticed? The Cold War had this simplistic dominance of realism. The strategic threat of nuclear weapons created a bipolar international system. With the collapse of one of these magnets, literally it's completely rotting away. In some sense, I would argue that even though we have a unipolar moment, it's more accurate to call it a uni-multipolar system, in the sense that there is really no more systemic threat or even a systemic international relations. It has moved down, it has descended to the international politics of regions. And here's where suddenly we have a contention between a realist and an idealist vision. And here's where I would argue there is a disjuncture between Europe and Asia. In Europe, thanks to a deep sort of development of post-war institutions, the Western European Union, Europeans' cooperation and security community, NATO, that there's an institutional fabric for a collective security arrangement in Europe following principles of a community of nations. That does not exist in Asia. There is not one God, for example, animating a universal principle in Asia. There are vastly different cultures and perspectives, and I would argue that as idealism may have taken root in Asia, in Europe, realism will have to be the guide in Asia. With the lack of institutions, one will have to seek balances of power. And a very critical component of this balances of power notion here in Asia, and this is the note that I will close on, Americans have a tendency to permit themselves to be underestimated. by adversaries and can seduce people into calculations of American weakness leading to war, the Gulf War being a classic point. The British, when they faced a new world of contracting resources, etc., decided in 1968 to withdraw east of Suez to become, in effect, a regional power. Whatever else one may thought of the peace dividend, it went from 6% to 4%. If it had gone down to 2%, we would have had to sacrifice one of the major regional contingencies and have been a one-theater power. I'm suggesting by the statistics that I think I laid out that withdrawing from Asia is not an option for the future of our society, as much as there may have been some seductive calls for that at an earlier stage. We need to be sure that the Chinese understand that by not wild rhetoric, but firm behavior and deeds, because if at the root of Hainan Island is an attempt to push the United States out of Asia, that will mean war.